It didn't seem fitting for Brinker Hadley, the hub of the class, to be congratulating me on influence. I was going to say that while he had a roommate, it was frightened Brownie Perkins, who would never impinge on Brinker's comfort in any way, and that they had two rooms, the front one with a fireplace. Not that I grudged him any of this. I liked Brinker, in spite of his winter session efficiency. Almost everyone liked Brinker. But in the pause I took before replying, he started talking in his light-hearted way again. He never let a dull spot appear in conversation if he could help it. "I'll bet you knew all the time Finney wouldn't be back this fall. That's why you picked him for a roommate, right?" "What?" I pulled quickly around in my chair, away from the desk, and faced him. "No, of course not. How could I know a thing like that in advance?" Brinker glanced swiftly at me. "You fixed it." He smiled widely. "You knew all the time. I bet it was all your doing." "Don't be nutty, Brinker." I turned back toward the desk and began moving books with rapid pointlessness. "What a crazy thing to say!" My voice sounded too strained, even to my own blood-pounded ears. "Ah, the truth hurts, huh?" I looked at him as sharply as eyes can look. He had struck an accusing pose. "Sure," I gave a short laugh. "Sure." Then these words came out of me by themselves. "But the truth will out." His hand fell leadenly on my shoulder. "Rest assured of that, my son. In our free democracy, even fighting for its life, the truth will out." I got up. "I feel like a smoke, don't you? Let's go down to the butt room."
"Yes, yes, to the dungeon with you."
The butt room was something like a dungeon. It was in the basement, or bowels, of the dormitory. There were about 10 smokers already there. Everyone at Devon had many public faces. In class, we looked, if not exactly scholarly, at least respectably alert. On the playing fields, we looked like innocent extroverts. In the butt room, we looked, very strongly, like criminals. The school's policy, in order to discourage smoking, was to make these rooms as depressing as possible. The windows near the ceiling were small and dirty. The old leather furniture spilled its innards. The tables were mutilated, the walls ash-colored, the floor concrete. A radio with a faulty connection played loud and rasping for a while, then suddenly quiet and insinuating.
"Here's your prisoner, gentlemen," announced Brinker,
seizing my neck and pushing me into the butt room ahead of him.
"I'm turning him over to the proper authorities."
High spirits came hard in the haze of the butt room. A slumped figure near the radio, which happened to be playing loud at the moment, finally roused himself to say,
"What's the charge?"
"Doing away with his roommate so he could have the whole room to himself. Rankous treachery."
He paused impressively.
"Practically fratricide."
With a snap of the neck, I shook his hand off me, my teeth set.
"Brinker!"
He raised an arresting hand.
"Not a word, not a sound. You'll have your day in court."
"God damn it, shut up! I swear to God, you write a joke longer than anyone I know!" It was a mistake. The radio had suddenly gone quiet, and my voice, ringing in the abrupt, releasing hush, galvanized them all.
"So, you killed him, did you?"
A boy uncoiled tensely from the couch.
"Well," Brinker qualified judiciously, "not exactly killed. Finney's hanging between life and death at home, in the arms of his grief-stricken old mother."
I had to take part in this, or risk losing control completely.
"I didn't do hardly a thing,"
I began as easily as it was possible for me to do. All I did was drop a little pinch of arsenic in his morning coffee."
"Liar!"
Brinker glowered at me.
"Trying to weasel out of it with a false confession, eh?"
I laughed at that. Laughed uncontrollably for a moment at that.
"We know the scene of the crime," Brinker went on. "High in that funereal tree by the river. There wasn't any poison. Nothing as subtle as that."
"Oh, you know about the tree?"
I tried to let my face fall guiltily, but it felt instead as though it were being dragged downward.
"Yes, there was a small,
a little contretemps at the tree?
No one was diverted from the issue by this try at a funny French pronunciation.
Tell us everything,
a younger boy at the table said huskily. There was an unsettling current in his voice, a genuinely conspiratorial note, as though he believed literally everything that had been said. His attitude seemed to me almost obscene, the attitude of someone who discovers a sexual secret of yours and promises not to tell a soul if you'll describe it in detail to him.
Well, I replied in a stronger voice, first, I stole all his money. Then I found that he cheated on his entrance tests to Devon, and I blackmailed his parents about that. Then I made love to his sister in Mr. Ludsbury's study. Then I...
He was going well. Faint grins were appearing around the room. Even the younger boy seemed to suspect that he was being sincere about a joke. A bad mistake to make at Devon.
Then I...
I only had to add, pushed him out of the tree, and the chain of implausibility would be complete.
Then I...
Just those few words, and perhaps this dungeon nightmare would end. But I could feel my throat closing on them. I could never say them. Never.
I swung on the younger boy.
What did I do then?
I demanded. I bet you've got a lot of theories. Come on, reconstruct the crime. There we were at the tree. Then what happened, Sherlock Holmes?
His eyes swung guiltily back and forth.
Then you just pushed him off, I bet.
Lousy bet, I said offhandedly, falling into a chair as though losing interest in the game.
You lose.
I guess you're Dr. Watson after all. They laughed at him a little, and he squirmed and looked guiltier than ever. He had a very weak foothold among the buttroom crowd, and I had pretty well pushed him off it. His glance flickered out at me from his defeat, and I saw, to my surprise, that I had, by making fun of him, brought upon myself his unmixed hatred. For my escape, this was a price I was willing to pay.
French! French! I exclaimed. Enough of this contretemps! I've got to study my French!
And I went out. Going up the stairs, I heard a voice from the butt room say,
Funny. He came all the way down here and didn't even have a smoke.
But this was a clue they soon seemed to forget. I detected no Sherlock Holmes among them, nor even a Dr. Watson. No one showed any interest in tracking me. No one pried. No one insinuated. The daily list of appointments lengthened with the rays of the receding autumn sun until the summer, the opening day, even yesterday, became by the middle of October something gotten out of the way and forgotten, because tomorrow bristled with so much to do. In addition to classes and sports and clubs, there was the war. Brinker Hadley can compose his shortest war poem ever written.
The war is a bore.
If he wanted to, but all of us had to take stronger action than that. First, there was the local apple crop, threatening to rot because the harvesters had all gone into the army or war factories. We spent several shining days picking them and were paid in cash for it. Brinker was inspired to write his apple ode.
Our chore is the core of the war.
And the novelty and the money of these days excited us. Life at Devon was revealed as still very close to the ways of peace. The war was at worst only a bore, as Brinker said. No more taxing to us than a day spent at harvesting in an apple orchard. Not long afterward, early even for New Hampshire, snow came. It came theatrically, late one afternoon. I looked up from my desk and saw that suddenly there were big flakes twirling down in the quadrangle, settling on the carefully pruned shrubbery bordering the sidewalks, the three elms still holding many of their leaves, the still green lawns. They gathered there, thicker by the minute, like noiseless invaders conquering because they took possession so gently. I watched them whirl past my window. Don't take this seriously, the playful way they fell seemed to imply. This little show, this harmless trick. It seemed to be true. The school was thinly blanketed that night. But the next morning, a bright, almost balmy day, every flake disappeared. The following weekend, however, it snowed again. Then, 2 days later, much harder.
and by the end of that week, the ground had been clamped under snow for the winter. In the same way, the war, beginning almost humorously with announcements about maids and days spent at apple picking, commenced its invasion of the school. The early snow was commandeered as its advanced guard. Leber Lepelier didn't suspect this. It was not, in fact, evident to anyone at first, but Leber stands out for me as the person who was most often and most emphatically taken by surprise by this and every other shift in our life at Devon. The heavy snow paralyzed the railroad yards of one of the large towns south of us on the Boston and Maine line. At chapel the day following the heaviest snowfall, 200 volunteers were solicited to spend the day shoveling them out as part of the emergency usefulness policy adopted by the faculty that fall. Again, we would be paid. So we all volunteered. Brinker and I and Chet Douglas, and even, I noticed, Quackenbush. But not Leper. He generally made little sketches of birds and trees in the back of his notebook during chapel, so that he had probably not heard the announcement. The train to take us south to work did not arrive until after lunch, and on my way to the station, taking a shortcut through a meadow not far from the river, I met Leper. I had hardly seen him all fall. I hardly recognized him now. He was standing motionless on the top of a small ridge, and he seemed from a distance to be a scarecrow left over from the growing season. As I plodded toward him through the snow, I began to differentiate items of clothing. A dull green deerstalker's cap, brown earmuffs, a thick gray woolen scarf. Then at last I recognized the face in the midst of them. Leper's, pinched and pink, his eyes peering curiously toward some distant woods through steel-rimmed glasses. As I got nearer, I noticed that below his long, tan canvas coat with sagging pockets, below the red and black plaid woolen knickers and green puttees, he was wearing skis. They were very long, wooden and battered, and had two decorative old-fashioned knobs on their tips.
"You think there's a path through these woods?"
he asked in his mild, tentative voice when I got near. Leper did not switch easily from one train of thought to another, and even though I was an old friend who he had not talked to in months, I didn't mind his taking me for granted now, even at this improbable meeting in a wide, empty field of snow.
"I'm not sure, Leper, but I think there's one at the bottom of the slope."
"Oh, yeah, I guess there is."
We always called him Leper to his face. He wouldn't have remembered to respond to any other name. I couldn't keep from staring at him, at this burlesque explorer look of him.
"What are you,"
I asked at last, "what are you doing anyway?"
"I'm touring."
"Touring?" I examined the long bamboo ski poles he held.
"How do you mean, touring?"
"Touring. It's the way you get around the countryside in the winter. Touring skiing. It's how you go overland in the snow."
"Where are you going?"
"Well, I'm not going anywhere."
He bent down to tighten the lacings on his puttee.
"I'm just touring around."
"There's that place across the river where you could ski. The place where they have the rope tow on that steep hill across from the railroad station. You could go over there."
"No, I don't think so."
He surveyed the woods again, although his breath had fogged his glasses.
"That's not skiing."
"Why, sure that's skiing. It's a good little run. You can get going pretty fast on that hill."
"Yeah, but that's it. That's why it isn't skiing. Skiing isn't supposed to be fast. Skis are for useful locomotion."
He turned his inquiring eyes on me.
"You can break a leg with that downhill stuff."
"Not on that little hill."
"Well, it's the same thing. It's part of the whole wrong idea. They're ruining skiing in this country. Rope toes and chair lifts and all that stuff. You get catted up and then you whiz down. You never get to see the trees or anything. Oh, you see a lot of trees shoot by, but you never get to really look at trees, at a tree. I just like to go along and see what I'm passing and enjoy myself."
He had come to the end of his thought, and now he slowly took me in, noticing my layers of old clothes.
"What are you doing anyway?"
He he asked mildly and curiously. "Going to work on the railroad." He kept gazing mildly and curiously at me. "Shovel out those tracks. The work that they talked about in chapel this morning? You remember."
"Have a nice day at it anyway," he said.
"I will. You too."
"I will if I find what I'm looking for. A beaver dam. It used to be up the Devon a ways, in a little stream that flows into the Devon. It's interesting to see the way beavers adapt to the winter. Have you ever seen it?"
"No, I never have seen that."
"Well, you might want to come sometime, if I find the place."
"Tell me if you find it." With Leper, it was always a fight, a hard fight to win when you were 17 years old and lived in a keyed-up competing school, to avoid making fun of him. But as I gotten to know him better, this fight had been easier to win. Shoving in his long bamboo poles, he pushed deliberately forward and slid slowly away from me down the gradual slope, standing very upright, his skis far apart to guard against any threat to his balance, his poles sticking out on either side of him, as though to ward off any interference. I turned and trudged off to help shovel out New England for the war. We spent an odd day toiling in that railroad yard. By the time we arrived there, the snow had become drab and sooted, wet and heavy. We were divided into gangs, each under an old railroad man. Brinker, Chet, and I managed to be in the same group, but the playful atmosphere of the apple orchard was gone. Of the town, we could only see some dull, red brick mills and warehouses surrounding the yards, and we labored away among what the old man directing us called rolling stock, grim freight cars from many parts of the country, immobilized in the snow. Brinker asked him if it shouldn't be called unrolling stock now, and the old man looked back at him with bleary dislike and didn't reply. Nothing was very funny that day. The work became hard and unvarying. I began to sweat under my layers of clothes. By the middle of the afternoon, we had lost our fresh volunteer look. The grime of the railroad and the exhaustion of manual laborers were on us all. We seemed of a piece with the railroad yards and the mills and the warehouses. The old man resented us. Or we made him nervous, or maybe he was as sick as he looked. For whatever reason, he grumbled and spat, and alternated between growling orders and rubbing his big, unhealthy belly. Around 4:30, there was a moment of cheer. The main line had been cleared, and the first train rattled slowly through. We watched it advance toward us, the engine throwing up balls of steam to add to the heavy overcast. All of us lined both sides of the track, and got ready to cheer the engineer and passengers. The coach windows were open, and the passengers, surprisingly, were hanging out. They were all men, I could discern, all young, all alike. It was a troop train. Over the clatter and banging of the wheels and couplings, we cheered and they yelled back, both sides, taken by surprise. They were not much older than we were, and although probably just recruits, they gave the impression of being an elite, as they were carried past our drab ranks. They seemed to be having a wonderful time. Their uniforms looked new and good. They were clean and energetic. They were going places. After they had gone, we laborers looked rather emptily across the newly cleared rails at each other, at ourselves, and not even Brinker thought of a timely remark. We turned away. The old man told us to go back to other parts of the yard, but there was no more real work done that afternoon. Stranded in this mill town railroad yard, while the whole world was converging elsewhere, we seemed to be nothing but children playing among heroic men. The day ended at last. Gray from the beginning, its end was announced by a deepening gray of sky, snow, faces, spirits. We piled back into the old, dispiritedly lit coaches waiting for us, slumped into the uncomfortable green seats, and no one said much until we were miles away. When we did speak, it was about aviation training programs and brothers in the service and requirements for enlistment and the futility of Devon, and how we would never have war stories to tell our grandchildren, and how long the war might last, and who ever heard of studying dead languages at a time like this? Quackenbush took advantage of a break in this line of conversation to announce that he would certainly stay at Devon through the year, however half-cocked others might rush off. He elaborated without encouragement, citing the advantages of Devon's physical hardening program and of a high school diploma when he did, in good time, reach basic training. He, for one, would advance into the army step by step.
"You, for one," echoed someone contemptuously.
"You are one,"
someone else said.
"Which army, Quackenbush? Mussolini's? Nah, he's a kraut. He's a kraut spy! How many rails did you sabotage today, Quackenbush?
I thought they interned all Quackenbushes the day after Pearl Harbor."
To which Brinker added,
"They didn't find him. He hid his light under a Quackenbush."
We were all tired at the end of that day. Walking back to the school grounds from the railroad station in the descending darkness, we overtook a lone figure sliding along the snow-covered edge of the street.
"Will you look at LaPellier?" began Brinker irritably.
"Who does he think he is, the abominable snowman?"
"He's just been out skiing around," I said quickly. I didn't want to see today's strained tempers exploding on Leper. Then, as we came up beside him,
"Did you find the dam, Leper?"
He turned his head slowly, without breaking his forward movement of alternately planted poles and thrust skis, rhythmically but feebly continuous, like a homemade piston engine's.
"You know what? I did find it."
His smile was wide and unfocused, as though not for me alone, but for anyone and anything which wished to share his pleasure with him.
"And it was really interesting to see. I took some pictures of it. If they come out, I'll bring them over and show you."
"What dam is that?"
Brinker asked me.
"It's a, well, a little dam up the river he knows about," I said.
"I don't know of any dam up the river."
"Well, it's not in the Devon itself. It's in one of the tributaries."
"Tributaries? To the Devon?"
"You know, a little creek or something." He knit his brows in mystification.
"What kind of a dam is this, anyway?"
"Well," he couldn't be put off with a half-story, "it's a beaver dam." Brinker's shoulders fell under the weight of this news.
"That's the kind of a place I'm in, with a world war going on. A school for photographers of beaver dams."
"The beaver never appeared himself,"
Leper offered. Brinker turned elaborately toward him.
"Didn't he really?"
"No, but I guess I was pretty clumsy getting close to it, so he might have heard me and been frightened."
"Well."
Brinker's expansive, dazed tone suggested that here was one of life's giant ironies.
"There you are."
"Yes,"
agreed Leper after a thoughtful pause.
"There you are."
"Here we are,"
I said, pulling Brinker around the corner we had reached, which led to our dormitory. "So long, Leper. Glad you found it."
"Oh!"
He raised his voice after us.
"How was your day? How did the work go?"
"Just like a stag at eve," Brinker roared back. "It was a winter wonderland every minute."
And out of the side of his mouth to me,
"Everybody in this place is either a draft-dodging kraut or a...
The scornful force of his tone turned the word into a curse.
"A naturalist."
He grabbed my arm agitatedly.
"I'm giving it up. I'm going to enlist tomorrow."
I felt a thrill when he said it. This was the logical climax of the whole misbegotten day, this whole out-of-joint term at Devon. I think I'd been waiting for a long time for someone to say this so that I could entertain these decisive words myself. To enlist, to slam the door impulsively on the past, to shed everything down to my last bit of clothing, to break the pattern of my life, that complex design I had been weaving since birth with all its dark threads, its unexplainable symbols set against a conventional background of domestic white and schoolboy blue. All those tangled strands which require the dexterity of a virtuoso to keep flowing. I yearned to take giant military shears to it. Snap! Bitten off in an instant, and nothing left in my hands but spools of khaki, which could weave only a plain, flat, khaki design, however twisted they might be. not that it would be a good life. The war would be deadly, all right. But I was used to finding something deadly in things that attracted me. There was always something deadly lurking in anything I wanted. Anything I loved. And if it wasn't there, as for example with Phineas, then I put it there myself. But in the war, there was no question about it at all. It was there. I separated from Brinker in the quadrangle, since one of his clubs was meeting, and he could not go back to the dormitory yet.
"I've got to preside at the meeting of the Golden Fleece Debating Society tonight," he said in a tone of amazed contempt. "The Golden Fleece Debating Society! We're mad here! All mad!"
And he went off, raving to himself in the dark. It was a night made for hard thoughts. Sharp stars pierced singly through the blackness. Not sweeps of them, or clusters, or Milky Ways, as there might have been in the south, but single, chilled points of light, as unromantic as knife blades. Devon, muffled under the gentle occupation of the snow, was dominated by them. The cold Yankee stars ruled this night. They did not invoke in me thoughts of God, or sailing before the mast, or some great love as crowded night skies at home had done. I thought instead, in the light of those cold points, of the decision facing me. Why go through the motions of getting an education and watch the war slowly chip away at the one thing I had loved here? The peace, the measureless, careless peace of the Devon summer. Others, the Quackenbushes of this world, could calmly watch the war approach them and jump into it at the last and most advantageous instant, as though buying into the stock market. But I couldn't. There was no one to stop me but myself. Putting aside soft reservations about what I owed Devon and my duty to my parents and so on, I reckoned my responsibilities by the light of the unsentimental night sky and knew that I owed no one anything. I owed it to myself to meet this crisis in my life when I chose, and I chose now. I bounced zestfully up the dormitory stairs, perhaps because my mind still retained the image of the sharp night stars, those few fixed points of light in the darkness. Perhaps because of that, the warm yellow light streaming from under my own door came as such a shock. It was a simple case of a change of expectation. The light should have been off. Instead, as though alive itself, it poured in a thin yellow slab of brightness from under the door, illuminating the dust and splinters of the hall floor. I grabbed the knob and swung open the door. He was seated in my chair at the desk, bending down to adjust the gross encumbrance of his leg, so that only the familiar ears set close against his head were visible, and his short-cut brown hair. He looked up with a provocative grin.
"Hi, pal! Where's the brass band?"
Everything that had happened throughout the day faded like that first false snowfall of the winter. Phineas was back. Chapter 8.
"I can see I never should have left you alone,"
Phineas went on before I could recover from the impact of finding him there.
"Where did you get those clothes?"
His bright, indignant eyes swept from my battered gray cap, down the frayed sweater and paint-stained pants to a pair of clodhoppers.
"You don't have to advertise like that. We all know you're the worst-dressed man in the class."
"I've been working, that's all. These are just work clothes."
"In the boiler room?"
"On the railroad, shoveling snow." He sat back in the chair.
"Shoveling railroad snow. Well, that makes sense. We always did that first term."
I pulled off the sweater, under which I was wearing a rain slicker I used to go sailing in, a kind of canvas sack. Phineas just studied it in wordless absorption.
"I like the cut of it,"
he finally murmured. I pulled that off, revealing an army fatigue shirt my brother had given me.
"Very topical," said Phineas through his teeth.
After that came off, there was just my undershirt, stained with sweat. He smiled at it for a while, and then said, as he heaved himself out of the chair,
There. You should have worn that all day. Just that. That has real taste. The rest of your outfit was just gilding that lily of a sweatshirt.
Glad to hear you like it.
Not at all,
he replied ambiguously, reaching for a pair of crutches which leaned against the desk. I took the sight of this all right. I had seen him on crutches the year before when he broke his ankle playing football. At Devon, crutches had almost as many athletic associations as shoulder pads. And I had never seen an invalid whose skin glowed with such health, accenting the sharp clarity of his eyes, or one who used his arms and shoulders on crutches as though on parallel bars, as though he would do a somersault on them if he felt like it. Phineas vaulted across the room to his cot, yanked back the spread, and then groaned,
"Oh, Christ! It's not made up! What is all this crap about no maids?"
"No maids," I said. "After all, there is a war on. It's not much of a sacrifice when you think of people starving and being bombed and all the other things." My unselfishness was responding properly to the influences of 1942. In these past months, Phineas and I had grown apart on this. I felt a certain disapproval of him for grumbling about a lost luxury with a war on. "After all," I repeated, "there is a war on."
"Is there?" he murmured absently.
I didn't pay any attention. He was always speaking when his thoughts were somewhere else, asking rhetorical questions and echoing other people's words. I found some sheets and made up his bed for him. He wasn't a bit sensitive about being helped, not a bit like an invalid striving to seem independent. I put this on the list of things to include when I said some prayers, the first in a long time, that night in bed. Now that Phineas was back, it seemed time to start saying prayers again. After the lights went out, the special quality of my silence let him know that I was saying them, and he kept quiet for approximately 3 minutes. Then he began to talk. He never went to sleep without talking first, and he seemed to feel that prayers lasting more than 3 minutes were showing off. God was always unoccupied in Finney's universe, ready to lend an ear any time at all. Anyone who failed to get his message through in 3 minutes, as I sometimes failed to do when trying to impress him, Phineas, with my sanctity, wasn't trying. He was still talking when I fell asleep, and the next morning, through the icy atmosphere which one window raised an inch had admitted to our room, he woke me with the over-indignant shout,
"What is all this crap about no maids?"
He was sitting up in bed, as though ready to spring out of it, totally and energetically awake. I had to laugh at this indignant athlete with the strength of 5 people complaining about the service. He threw back his bedclothes and said,
"Hand me my crutches, will you?"
Until now, in spite of everything, I had welcomed each new day as though it were a new life, where all past failures and problems were erased, and all future possibilities and joys open and available, to be achieved probably before night fell again. Now, in this winter of snow and crutches with Phineas, I began to know that each morning reasserted the problems of the night before, that sleep suspended all, but changed nothing, that you couldn't make yourself over between dawn and dusk. Phineas, however, didn't believe this. I'm sure that he looked down at his leg every morning first thing, as soon as he remembered it, to see if it had not been totally restored while he slept. When he found on this first morning back at Devon that it happened still to be crippled and in a cast, he said in his usual self-contained way,
"Hand me my crutches, will you?"
Brinker Hadley, next door, always woke like an express train. There was a gathering rumble through the wall as Brinker reared up in bed, coughed hoarsely, slammed his feet on the floor, pounded through the freezing air to the closet for something in the way of clothes, and thundered down the hall to the bathroom. Today, however, he veered and broke into our room instead.
"Ready to sign up?" he shouted before he was through the door. "You ready to en-"
"Finny!"
"You ready to en- what?"
pursued Finny from his bed.
"Who's ready to sign an en- what?"
"Finny, by God, you're back!"
"Sure,"
confirmed Finny with a slight pleased grin.
"So,"
Brinker curled his lip at me,
Your little plot didn't work so well after all.
What's he talking about?
Said Finney as I thrust his crutches beneath his shoulders. Just talking, I said shortly. What does Brinker ever talk about?
You know what I'm talking about well enough.
No, I don't.
Oh, yes, you do.
Are you telling me what I know?
Damn right I am.
What's he talking about?
Said Finney. The room was bitterly cold. I stood trembling in front of Phineas, still holding his crutches in place, unable to turn and face Brinker, and this joke he had gotten into his head, this catastrophic joke.
He wants to know if I'll sign up with him, I said.
Enlist? It was the ultimate question for all 17-year-olds that year, and it drove Brinker's insinuations from every mind but mine.
Yeah, said Brinker.
Enlist?
Cried Finney at the same time. His large and clear eyes turned with an odd expression on me.
I had never seen such a look in them before.
After looking at me closely, he said,
You're going to enlist?
Well, I just thought, last night after the railroad work.
You thought you might sign up?
He went on, looking carefully away. Brinker drew one of his deep senatorial breaths, but he found nothing to say. We three stood shivering in the thin New Hampshire morning light, Finney and I in pajamas, Brinker in a blue flannel bathrobe and ripped moccasins.
When will you?
Finney went on. Oh, I don't know, I said. It was just something Brinker happened to say last night, that's all.
I said,
Brinker began in an unusually guarded voice, glancing quickly at Phineas.
I said something about enlisting today.
Finney hobbled over to the dresser and took up his soap dish.
I'm first in the shower, he said.
You can't get that cast wet, can you?
Asked Brinker.
No, I'll keep it outside the curtain.
I'll help, said Brinker.
No, said Finney without looking at him. I can manage all right.
How can you manage all right?
Brinker persisted aggressively.
I can manage all right,
Finney repeated with a set face. I could hardly believe it, but it was too plainly printed in the close expression of his face to mistake, too discernible beneath the even tone of his voice. Phineas was shocked at the idea of my leaving. In some way, he needed me. He needed me. I was the least trustworthy person he had ever met. I knew that. He knew, or should know that, too. I had even told him. I had told him. But there was no mistaking the shield of remoteness in his face and voice. He wanted me around. The war then passed away from me, and dreams of enlistment and escape and a clean start lost their meaning for me. Sure, you can manage the shower all right, I said. But what difference does it make? Come on, Brinker's always getting there first. Enlist? What a nutty idea. That's just Brinker wanting to get there first again. I wouldn't enlist with you if you were General MacArthur's eldest son.
Brinker reared back arrogantly. And who do you think I am?
But Finney hadn't heard that. His face had broken into a wide and dazzled smile at what I had said, lighting up his whole face.
Enlist? I drove on. I wouldn't enlist with you if you were Elliot Roosevelt. First cousin, said Brinker over his chin, once removed.
He wouldn't enlist with you, Finney plunged in, if you were Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
Well, I qualified in an undertone, he really is Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
Well, fan my brow, cried
Finney, giving us his stunned look of total, appalled, horrified amazement.
Who would have thought that? Chinese! The Yellow Peril! Right here at Devon!
And as far as the history of the class of 1943 at the Devon School was concerned, this was the only part of our conversation worth preserving. Brinker Hadley had been tagged with a nickname at last, after 4 years of creating them for others and eluding one himself. Yellow Peril Hadley swept through the school with the speed of a flu epidemic, and it must be said to his credit that Brinker took it well enough, except when, in its inevitable abbreviation, people sometimes called him Yellow
instead of peril. But in a week, I had forgotten that. And I have never since forgotten the dazed look on Finney's face when he thought that on the first day of his return to Devon, I was going to desert him. I didn't know why he had chosen me, why it was only to me that he could show his most humbling sides of his handicap. I didn't care, for the war was no longer eroding the peaceful summertime stillness I had prized so much at Devon, and although the playing fields were crusted under a foot of congealed snow, and the river was now a hard gray-white lane of ice between gaunt trees, peace had come back to Devon for me. So the war swept over like a wave at the seashore, gathering power and size as it bore on us, overwhelming in its rush, seemingly inescapable, and then, at the last moment, eluded by a word from Phineas. I had simply ducked. That was all. And the wave's concentrated power had hurtled harmlessly overhead, no doubt throwing others roughly up on the beach, but leaving me peaceably treading water as before. I did not stop to think that one wave is inevitably followed by another, even larger and more powerful, when the tide is coming in. "I like the winter," Finney assured me for the fourth time as we came back from chapel that morning. "Well, it doesn't like you." Wooden plank walks had been placed on many of the school's paths for better footing, but there were icy patches everywhere on them. A crutch misplaced and he could be thrown down upon the frozen wooden planking or into the ice-encrusted snow. Even indoors, Devon was a nest of traps for him. The school had been largely rebuilt with a massive bequest from an oil family some years before in a peculiar style of Puritan grandeur, as though Versailles had been modified for the needs of a Sunday school. This opulent sobriety betrayed the divided nature of the school, just as, in a different way, the two rivers that it straddled did. From the outside, the buildings were reticent, severe straight lines of red brick or white clapboard, with shutters standing sentinel beside each window, and a few unassuming white cupolas placed here and there on the roofs because they were expected and not pretty, like pilgrim bonnets. But once you pass through the colonial doorways, with only an occasional fan window or low-relief pillar to suggest that a certain muted adornment was permissible, you entered an extravaganza of pompadour splendor. Pink marble walls and white marble floors were enclosed by arched and vaulted ceilings. An assembly room had been done in the manner of high Italian Renaissance. Another was illuminated by chandeliers flashing with crystal teardrops. There was a wall of fragile French windows overlooking an Italian garden of marble bric-a-brac. The library was Provençal on the first floor, Rococo on the second. And everywhere, except in the dormitories, the floors and stairs were of smooth, slick marble, more treacherous than even the icy walks. "The winter loves me," he retorted. And then, disliking the whimsical sound of that, added, "I mean as much as you can say a season can love. What I mean is, I love winter. And when you really love something, then it loves you back in whatever way it has to love." I didn't think that this was true. My 17 years of experience had shown this to be much more false than true. But it was like every other thought and belief of Finney's. It should have been true. So I didn't argue. The boardwalk ended, and he moved a little ahead of me as we descended a sloping path toward our first class. He picked his way with surprising care, surprising in anyone who before used the ground mainly as a point of departure, as the given element in a suspended world of leaps in space. And now I remembered what I had never taken any special note of before, how Phineas used to walk. Around Devon we had gaits of every description, gangling shuffles from boys who had suddenly grown a foot taller, swinging cowboy lopes from those thinking of how wide their shoulders had become, ambles, waddles, light trippings, gigantic bunion strides. But Phineas had moved in continuous, flowing balance, so that he had seemed to drift along with no effort at all. Relaxation on the move. He hobbled now among the patches of ice. There was one certainty that Dr. Stanpole had given.
Phineas would walk again. But the thought was there before me that he would never walk like that again.
"Do you have a class?"
he said as we reached the steps of the building.
"Yes." "So do I."
"Let's not go."
"Not go? What'll we use for an excuse?"
"We'll say I fainted from exertion on the way from chapel." He looked at me with a phantom smile. "And you had to tend me.
This is your first day back, Finny. You're no one to cut classes."
"I know, I know. I'm going to work. I really am going to work. You're going to pull me through mostly, but I am going to work as hard as I can. Only not today. Not the first thing. Not now. Not conjugating verbs when I haven't even looked at the school yet. I want to see this place. I haven't seen anything except the inside of our room and the inside of the chapel. I don't feel like seeing the inside of a classroom. Not now. Not yet. What do you want to see?"
He started to turn around so that his back was to me.
"Let's go to the gym," he said shortly. The gym was at the other end of the school, a quarter of a mile away at least, separated from us by a field of ice. We set off without saying anything else.
By the time we reached it, sweat was running like oil from Finney's face, and when he paused, involuntary tremors shook his hands and arms.
The leg in its cast was like a sea anchor dragged behind. The illusion of strength I had seen in our room that morning must have been the same illusion he used at home to deceive his doctor and his family to sending him back to Devon. We stood on the ice-coated lawn in front of the gym while he got ready to enter it, resting himself so that he could go in with a show of energy. Later, this became his habit. I often caught up with him standing in front of a building, pretending to be thinking or examining the sky or taking off gloves. But it was never a convincing show. Phineas was a poor deceiver, having had no practice. We went into the gym, along a marble hallway, and to my surprise, we went on past the trophy room, where his name was already inscribed on one cup, one banner, and one embalmed football. I was sure that this was his goal, to mull over these lost glories. I had prepared myself for that, and even thought of several positive, uplifting aphorisms to cheer him up. But he went by without a thought, down a stairway, steep in marble, and into the locker room. I went along, mystified beside him. There was a pile of dirty towels in the corner. Finney shoved them with a crutch.
"What is all this crap?" he muttered with a little smile. "About no maids!"
The locker room was empty at this hour. Row after row of dull green lockers separated by wide wooden benches. The ceiling was hung with pipes. It was a drab room for Devon, dull green and brown and gray. But at the far end, there was a big marble archway, glistening white, which led to the pool. Finney sat down on a bench, struggled out of his sheep-lined winter coat, and took a deep breath of gymnasium air. No locker room could have more pungent air than Devon's. Sweat predominated, but it was richly mingled with smells of paraffin and singed rubber, of soaked wool and liniment, and for those who could interpret it, of exhaustion, lost hope and triumph, and bodies battling against each other. I thought it anything but a bad smell. It was preeminently the smell of the human body after it had been used to the limit. Such a smell has meaning and poignance for any athlete, just as it has for any lover. Phineas looked down here and there, at the exercise bar over a sandpit next to the wall, at a set of weights on the floor, at a rolled-up wrestling mat, at a pair of spiked shoes kicked under a locker.
"Same old place, isn't it?"
he said, turning to me and nodding slightly. After a moment, I answered in a quiet voice, "Not exactly." He made no pretense of not understanding me. After a pause, he said,
"You're going to be the big star now,"
in an optimistic tone, and then added with some embarrassment,
"You can fill any gaps or anything."
He slapped me on the back.
"Get over there and chin yourself a few dozen times. What did you finally go out for anyway?"
"I finally didn't go out."
"You aren't." His eyes burned at me from his grimacing face. "Still the assistant senior crew manager."
No, I quit that. I've just been going to gym classes, the ones they have for guys who aren't going out for anything. He wrenched himself around on the bench. Joking was past. His mouth widened irritably. What in hell? His voice bounded on the word in a sudden, rich descent. Did you do that for? It was too late to sign up for anything else. And seeing the energy to blast this excuse rushing into his face and neck, I stumbled on. And anyway, with the war on, there won't be many trips for the teams. I don't know. Sports don't seem so important with the war on.
Have you swallowed all that war stuff?
No, of course I was so committed to refuting him that I half denied the charge before I understood it. Now my eyes swung back to his face. All what war stuff?
All that stuff about there being a war.
I don't think I get what you mean.
Do you really think that the United States of America is in a state of war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan?
Do I really think that? My voice trailed off. He stood up, his weight on the good leg, the other resting lightly on the floor in front of him.
Don't be a sap!
He gazed with cool self-possession at me.
There isn't any war.
I know why you're talking like this, I said, struggling to keep up with him. Now I understand. You're still under the influence of some medicinal drug.
No, you are. Everybody is.
He pivoted so that he was facing directly at me.
That's what this whole war story is. A medicinal drug. Listen, did you ever hear of the Roaring Twenties?
I nodded very slowly and cautiously.
When they all drank bathtub gin and everybody who was young did just what they wanted?
Yes.
Well, what happened was that they didn't like that, the preachers and the old ladies and all the stuffed shirts. So then they tried prohibition, and everybody just got drunker. So then they really got desperate and arranged the Depression. That kept the people who were young in the 30s in their place. But they couldn't use that trick forever. So for us, in the 40s, they cooked up this war fake.
Who are they, anyway?
The fat old men who don't want us crowding them out of their jobs. They've made it all up. There isn't any real food shortage, for instance. The men have all the best steaks delivered to their clubs now. You've noticed how they've been getting fatter lately, haven't you?
His tone took it thoroughly for granted that I had. For a moment, I was almost taken in by it. Then my eyes fell on the bound and cast white mask pointing at me. And, as it was always to do, it brought me down out of Finney's world of invention, down again as I had fallen after awakening that morning, down to reality, to the facts. Phineas, this is all pretty amusing and everything, but I hope you don't play this game too much with yourself. You might start to believe it, and then I'd have to make a reservation for you at the Funny Farm.
In a way, deep in argument, his eyes never wavered from mine, the whole world is on a funny farm now. But it's only the fat old men who get the joke.
And you?
Yes, and me.
What makes you so special? Why should you get it and all the rest of us be in the dark? The momentum of the argument abruptly broke from his control. His face froze.
Because I've suffered,
he burst out. We drew back in amazement from this. In the silence, all the flighty spirits of the morning ended between us. He sat down, turned his flushed face away from me. I sat next to him, without moving for as long as my beating nerves would permit. And then I stood up and walked slowly toward anything which presented itself. It turned out to be the exercise bar. I sprang up, grabbed it, and then, in a fumbling and perhaps grotesque offering to Phineas, I chinned myself. I couldn't think of anything else. Not the right words, not the right gesture. I did what I could think of.
Do 30 of them,
he mumbled in a bored voice. I had never done 10 of them. At the 12th, I discovered that he had been counting to himself because he began to count aloud in a non-committal, half-heard voice. At 18, there was a certain enlargement in his tone, and at 23, the last edges of boredom left it. He stood up, and the urgency with which he brought out the next numbers was like an invisible boost lifting me the distance of my arms, until he sang out, 30! with a flare of pleasure. The moment was past. Phineas, I know, had been even more startled than I to discover this bitterness in himself. Neither of us ever mentioned it again, and neither of us ever forgot that it was there. He sat down and studied his clenched hands.
"Did I ever tell you," he began in a husky tone, "that I used to be aiming for the Olympics?"
He wouldn't have mentioned it, except that after what he had said, he had to say something very personal, something deeply held. To do otherwise, to begin joking, would have been a hypocritical denial of what had happened, and Phineas was not capable of that. I was still hanging from the bar. My hands felt as though they had sunk into it.
"No, you never told me that,"
I mumbled into my arm.
"Well, I was. And now I'm not sure, not 100% sure I'll be completely, you know, in shape by 1944. So I'm going to coach you for them instead.
But there isn't going to be any Olympics in 44. That's only a couple of years away. The war.
Leave your fantasy life out of this. We're grooming you for the Olympics, pal, in 1944.
And not believing him. Not forgetting that troops were being shuttled toward battlefields all over the world. I went along, as I always did with any new invention of Finney's. There was no harm in taking aim, even if the target was a dream. But since we were so far out of the line of fire, the chief sustenance for any sense of the war was mental. We saw nothing real of it. All of our impressions of the war were in the false medium of two dimensions. Photographs in the newspapers and magazines, newsreels, posters, or artificially conveyed to us by a voice on the radio or headlines across the top of a newspaper. I found that only through a continuous use of the imagination I could hold out against Finney's driving offensive in favor of peace. And now, when we were served chicken livers for dinner, I couldn't help conceiving a mental picture of President Roosevelt and my father and Finney's father and a number of other large old men sitting down to porterhouse steaks in some elaborate but secluded men's secret society room. When a letter from home told me that a trip to visit relatives had been canceled because of gas rationing, it was easy to visualize my father smiling silently with knowing eyes, at least as easy as it was to imagine an American force crawling through the jungles of a place called Guadalcanal.
"Wherever that is," as Phineas said.
And when in chapel, day after day, we were exhorted to new levels of self-deprivation and hard work, with the war as their justification, it was impossible not to see the faculty were using the excuse to drive us as they had always wanted to drive us, regardless of any war or peace. What a joke if Phinney was right after all! But of course, I didn't believe him. I was too well protected against the great fear of boys' school life, which was to be taken in. Along with everyone else, except a few professional gulls, such as Leper, I rejected anything that had the smallest possibility of doubt about it. So, of course, I didn't believe him. But one day, after our chaplain, Mr. Carhart, had become very moved by his own sermon in chapel about God in the foxholes, I came away thinking that if Finney's opinion of the war was unreal, Mr. Carhart's was at least as unreal. But, of course, I didn't believe him. And anyway, I was too occupied to think about it all. In addition to my own work, I was dividing my time between tutoring Finney in studies and being tutored by him in sports. Since so much of learning anything depends on the atmosphere in which it was taught, Finney and I, to our joint double amazement, began to make flashing progress where we had been bumblers before. Mornings we got up at 6 to run. I dressed in a gym sweatsuit with a towel tucked around my throat, and Finney in pajamas, ski boots, and his sheep-lined coat. A morning shortly before Christmas vacation brought my reward. I was to run the course Finney had laid out, 4 times around an oval walk which circled the headmaster's home, a large, rambling, doubtfully colonial white mansion. Next to the house, there was a patriarchal elm tree, against the trunk of which Finney leaned and shouted at me as I ran a large circle around him. The plain of snow shone a powdery white that morning. The sun blazed icily, somewhere too low on the horizon to be seen directly.
but its clean rays shed a blue-white glimmer all around us. The northern sunshine seemed to pick up faint particles of whiteness floating in the air and powdering the sleek blue sky. Nothing stirred. The bare arching branches of the elm seemed laid into this motionless sky. As I ran, the sound of my footfalls was pitched off short in the vast immobile dawn, as though there was no room amid so many glittering sights for any sound to intrude. The figure of Phineas was set against the bulk of the tree. He shouted now and then, but these sounds, too, were quickly absorbed and dispelled. And he needed to give no advice that morning. After making two circuits of the walk, every trace of energy was, as usual, completely used up. And as I drove myself on, all my scattered aches found their usual way to a profound seat of pain in my side. My lungs, as usual, were fed up with all this work, and from now on would only go rackingly through the motions. My knees were boneless again, ready any minute to let my lower legs telescope up into the thighs. My head felt as though different sections of the cranium were grinding into each other. Then, for no reason at all, I felt magnificent. It was as though my body, until that instant, had simply been lazy, as though the aches and exhaustion were all imagined, created from nothing in order to keep me from truly exerting myself. Now my body seemed at last to say, "Well, if you must have it, here." And an accession of strength came flooding through me. Buoyed up, I forgot my usual feeling of routine self-pity when working out. I lost myself. Oppressed mind along with aching body, all entanglements were shed. I broke into the clear. After the fourth circuit, like sitting in a chair, I pulled up in front of Phineas. "You're not even winded," he said. "I know." "You found your rhythm, didn't you? That third time around, just as you came into the straight part there." "Yes, right there." "You've been pretty lazy all along, haven't you?" "Yes, I guess I have been." "You didn't even know anything about yourself." "I don't guess I did, in a way." "Well," he gathered the sheepskin collar around his throat, "now you know. And stop talking like a Georgia cracker. Don't guess I did." Despite this jibe, he was rather impersonal toward me. He seemed older that morning, and leaning quietly against the great tree wrapped in his heavy coat, he seemed smaller, too. Or perhaps it was only that I, inside the same body, had felt myself all at once grown bigger. We proceeded slowly back to the dormitory. On the steps going in, we met Mr. Ludsbury coming out.
"I've been watching you from my window," he said in his hooting voice, with a rare trace of personal interest. "What are you up to, Forrester? Training for the commandos?"
There was no rule explicitly forbidding exercise at such an hour, but it was not expected. Ordinarily, therefore, Mr. Ludsbury would have disapproved. But the war had modified even his standards. All forms of physical exercise had become conventional for the duration. I mumbled some abashed answer, but it was Phineas who made the clear response.
"He's developing into a real athlete," he said matter-of-factly. "We're aiming for the 44 Olympics.
Mr. Ludsbury emitted a single chuckle from deep in his throat. Then his face turned brick red momentarily, and he assumed his customary sententiousness.
"Games are all right in their place," he said. "And I won't bore you with the Eton playing field's observation, but all exercise today is aimed, of course, at the approaching Waterloo. Keep that in your sights at all times, won't you?"
Finney's face set in determination, with the older look that I had just detected in him.
"No," he said.
I don't believe any student had ever said no flatly to Mr. Ludsbury before. It flustered him uncontrollably. His face turned brick red again, and for a moment I thought he was going to run away. Then he said something so rapid, throaty, and clipped that neither of us understood it, turned quickly, and strode off across the quadrangle.
"He's really sincere. He thinks there's a war on," said Finney in simple wonder. "Now why wouldn't he know?"
He pondered Mr. Ludsbury's exclusion from the plot of the fat old men as we watched his figure, reedy even in his winter wraps, move away from us. Then the light broke,
Oh, of course, he cried. Too thin! Of course!
I stood there, pitying Mr. Ledsbury for his fatal thinness, and reflecting that, after all, he had always had a gullible side. Chapter 9. This was my first, but not my last, lapse into Finney's vision of peace. For hours, and sometimes for days, I fell without realizing it into the private explanation of the world. Not that I ever believed that the whole production of World War II was a trick of the eye, manipulated by a bunch of calculating fat old men, appealing though this idea was. What deceived me was my own happiness. For peace is indivisible, and the surrounding world confusion found no reflection inside me. So I ceased to have any real sense of it. This was not shaken, even by the enlistment of Leper Lepelier. In fact, that made the war seem more unreal than ever. No real war could draw Leper voluntarily away from his snails and beaver dams. His enlistment seemed just another of Leper's vagaries, such as the time he slept on top of Mount Katahdin in Maine, where each morning the sun first strikes United States territory. On that morning, satisfying one of his urges to participate in nature, Leper Lepelier was the first thing the rising sun struck in the United States. Early in January, when we had all just returned from the Christmas holidays, a recruiter from the United States ski troops showed a film to the senior class in the Renaissance room. To Leper, it revealed what all of us were seeking, a recognizable and friendly face to the war. Skiers in white shrouds winged down virgin slopes, silent as angels, and then, realistically, herringboned up again, but herringboned in cheerful, sunburnt bands, with clear eyes and white teeth and chests full of vigor-laden mountain air. It was the cleanest image of the war I had ever seen. Even the Air Force, reputedly so high above the infantry's mud, was stained with axle grease by comparison, and the Navy was vulnerable to scurvy. Nothing tainted these white warriors of winter as they swooped down their spotless mountainsides, and this cool, clean response to the war glided straight into Leper's Vermont heart. "How do you like that?" he whispered to me in a wondering voice during these scenes. "How do you like that?" "You know, I think these are pictures of Finnish ski troops," Phineas whispered on the other side. "And I want to know when they start shooting our allies, the Bolsheviks, unless that war between them was a fake too, which I'm pretty sure it was." After the movie ended and the lights came on to illuminate the murals of Tuscany and the painted classical galleries around us, Leper still sat amazed in his folding chair. Ordinarily, he talked little, and the number of words which came from him now indicated that this was a turning point in his life. "You know what? Now I see what racing skiing is all about. It's all right to miss seeing the trees and the countryside and all the other things when you've got to be in a hurry. And when you're in a war, you've got to be in a hurry, don't you? So I guess maybe racing skiers weren't ruining the sport after all. They were preparing it, if you see what I mean, for the future. Everything has to evolve or else it perishes." Finney and I stood up, and Leper looked earnestly from one to the other of us from his chair. "Take the housefly. If it hadn't developed all those split-second reflexes, it would have become extinct long ago."
"You mean it adapted itself to the fly swatter?" queried Phineas.
"That's right. And skiing had to learn to move just as fast, or it would have been wiped out by this war."
"Yes, sir. You know what? I'm almost glad this war came along.
It's like a test, isn't it? And only the things and the people who've been evolving the right way survive."
You usually listen to Leper's quiet talking with half a mind, but this theory of his brought me to close attention. How did it apply to me, to Phineas? And most of all, how did it apply to Leper?
"I'm going to enlist in these ski troops," he went on mildly,
so unemphatically that my mind went back to half-listening. Threats to enlist that winter were always declaimed, like Brinker's,
with a grinding of back teeth and flashing of eyes. I had already heard plenty of them. But only lepers was serious. A week later, he was gone. He had been within a few weeks of his 18th birthday, and with it, all chance of enlistment, of choosing a service, rather than being drafted into one, would have disappeared. The ski movie had decided him.
"I always thought the war would come for me when it wanted me," he said when he came to say goodbye the last day. "I never thought I'd be going to it. I'm really glad I saw that movie in time. You bet I am."
Then, as the Devon School's first recruit to World War II, he went out my doorway with his white stocking cap bobbing behind. It probably would have been better for all of us if someone like Brinker had been the first to go. He could have been depended upon to take a loud, dramatic departure, so that the school would have reverberated for weeks afterward with Brinker's last words, Brinker's military bearing, Brinker's sense of duty. And all of us, influenced by the vacuum of his absence, would have felt the touch of war as a daily fact. But the disappearing tale of Leper's Cap inspired none of this. For a few days, the war was more unimaginable than ever. We didn't mention it, and we didn't mention Leper, until at last Brinker found a workable point of view. One day in the butt room, he read aloud a rumor in the newspaper about an attempt on Hitler's life. He lowered the paper, gazed in a visionary way in front of him, and then remarked, "That was Leper, of course." This established our liaison with World War II. The Tunisian campaign became Leper's Liberation. The bombing of the Ruhr was greeted by Brinker with hurt surprise.
"He didn't tell us he'd left the ski troops."
The torpedoing of the Scharnhorst.
"At it again."
Leper sprang up all over the world at the core of every Allied success. We talked about Leper's stand at Stalingrad, Leper on the Burma Road, Leper's convoy to Archangel. We surmised that the crisis over the leadership of the Free French would be resolved by the appointment of neither de Gaulle nor Giraud, but Lapellier. We knew, better than the newspapers, that it was not the Big Three, but the Big Four who were running the war. In the silences between jokes about Leper's glories, we wondered whether we ourselves would measure up to the humblest minimum standard of the army. I didn't know everything there was to know about myself, and I knew I didn't know it. I wondered in the silences between jokes about Leper whether the still hidden parts of myself might contain the sad sack, the outcast, or the coward. We were all at our funniest about Leper, and we all secretly hoped that Leper, that incompetent, was as heroic as we said. Everyone contributed to this legend, except Phineas. At the outset, with the attempt on Hitler's life, Phineas had said, "If someone gave Leper a loaded gun and put it at Hitler's temple, he'd miss." There was a general shout of outrage, and then we recommended the building of Leper's triumphal arch around Brinker's keystone. Phineas took no part in it, and since little else was talked about in the butt room, he soon stopped going there, and stopped me from going as well. "How do you expect to be an athlete if you smoke like a forest fire?" He drew me increasingly away from the butt room crowd, away from Brinker and Chet and all the other friends, into a world inhabited by just himself and me, where there was no war at all. Just Phineas and me alone among all the people of the world training for the Olympics of 1944.